Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
I'm HRN's Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We decided it's high time we do an episode about Mary Jane.
Marijuana, things are happening.
That's right. This episode is about pot. We're exploring the rhetoric surrounding legalization in New York's recent gubernatorial primaries. And a cheesemonger turned cannabis consultant shares the tricks of the trade.
Great. So do you want to conquer the world? Do you want to have hazy eyes? Do you want to, you know, just relax all day and be floaty?
And we find out how one exemplary South Carolina farmer is trying his hand at a new crop.
Every plant that comes up from seed is different. And so it's learning how the plant grows, how it responds, and then familiarizing myself and my senses with this plant.
Plus, Hannah Forden and I taste test the hottest new cocktail ingredient, CBD. So subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the newest episode of Meat and Three drops.
And welcome to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network, a show about food, politics, and identity. I'm your host tonight, Leah Kurtz, and we have in the studio with us Surbi Sahani of Sar Indian Bistro, and she's also been a chef in New York City for over 18 years and been working in the culinary field for over 25 years. Surbi, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, welcome. So we're just going to get right into it. What is one of your, first maybe like food memories? What got you interested in devoting your life to food?
I don't know. Earliest food memories in terms of eating is very different.
Yeah, the eating comes before the cooking, right? We'll start there.
I don't think my memory is going to necessarily, in terms of cooking, going to be I really liked it because I didn't like cooking. I was just kind of forced into it because my mom was very sick and I just had to cook to keep the family kind of going. From a very young age, say like 10, 12, I was just already involved in doing household things. In terms of like just kind of getting involved in the industry, so my dad is an artist in India and he paints. So my main goal always was I'm going to be an artist. I'm either going to paint or I'm going to sing or I'm going to write, or it's going to be one of those hemispheres of things that I'm going to kind of end up doing. Not that I worked towards it, but that was in the dream world. That is what I was doing. My dad had an exhibition in one of the hotels called Sheraton at one point. I ended up going there for this exhibition opening, and this was the first time I saw a hotel with like these beautiful glass shelves and the marble floors. And then I was just like, oh my God, I need to be working here.
And where in India was this?
This was in Delhi.
Okay.
And so then I remember I turned to my father and said, I'm going to do hotel management and I'm going to become a chef.
And at what age was this realization?
17.
Okay.
So, I was still also applying for art schools. But it was a little too late because I started working towards my art stuff a little later in India competition and stuff. I got through hotel management and my father said, that's what you're going to do. So 25 years later, I'm still cooking.
Wow. And so what was that trajectory of like, you did your degree in India?
Mm-hmm. I did my degree in India. And at that point, I was actually seeing someone who was very anti me becoming a chef because there were not that many women chefs mm-hmm. in the kitchen. When I joined hotels in Delhi, I think in the entire Delhi, which is a lot of hotels, there might have been maximum 25, 30 women in the kitchens. So I was one of those rare girls that was like, bravo, I'm going into it. We'll see. Not knowing what is it that I'm entering. I was also really lucky because when I started working at the Sheraton, there were these two women chefs at the Sheraton itself that started a women's kitchen at that time in the year 1995 mm-hmm. is what I'm talking about. They started a women's kitchen and they were trying to find as many women that were there in the kitchen. There were not that many. So we had an all-women's kitchen and an all-women's restaurant in the front. The only men wow. that we had were the bartenders because the Delhi law did not allow women to serve
what?
Alcohol. Yes, wow. because men would see women on the bar and think they're loose-charactered. And
oh, yes.
They would like come and touch them and feel like they can go home with them because then you're a loose
yeah.
kind of a
oh,
woman.
Very shameful. Very alcohol, so shameful.
So, yeah, that was the beginning of the career was but with all women chefs.
That's pretty incredible, though, and like at all ranks. They were female chefs.
All ranks, they were female chefs. We did have a few men in the kitchen eventually because there was a gap and there were not that many women available. But like we had a crew of, with our two main chefs, we had a crew of 8 girls.
And did it initially happen by accident or was it always very like intentional?
I think they started it as a women's kitchen and they were going around different universities or they did have another woman who was, well, commis chef, as we call them in the French kind of lineup. Mm-hmm. She was a commis chef and she was brought upstairs. And then we had a chef de cuisine who was also brought upstairs. They just kind of picked up girls throughout Delhi and just brought them into this main kitchen to run the kitchen. It was a lot of fun. I should say it was, you know, like we always say like, oh my God, women working together, a lot of bitchiness and a lot of fighting or whatever. It was nothing of that sort. I think like I had the most amount of fun, you know, yes, we fought a lot, but we fight even when the men are in the kitchen. So it's not any different. I just do feel like the sisterhood and the camaraderie that was kind of present in the kitchen and the sort of the sense of security mm-hmm. was very different.
And that was like your first introduction.
That's my first introduction.
Wow.
Well, I mean, I was working and I had worked as an intern or as a training throughout my bachelor's degree in different hotels. And I had worked throughout my hotel management career in the kitchen that was part of my school. But that's a very different experience from actually starting a job. My first job was mm-hmm. at an all-women's kitchen, yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. And what particular like role did you fulfill?
Oh, I mostly pulled stores a lot. So I went downstairs to the purchasing. I loaded up the trolley and I brought it upstairs and I unloaded it. And then I went downstairs again and I loaded it.
Oh my goodness.
All day long. I also did a lot of chopping.
Wow.
So we were hired 3 months before the restaurant was open. So I did a lot of, so back then there was no pasta companies that were selling pasta in India as much, or it was extremely expensive. So we had a pasta machine. We would make our pastas and we dried our pastas. We made, we made our own sun-dried tomatoes. We made our own pestos. We stored them in jars. We made, got jalapenos and we pickled them. We pickled everything under the sun. That was part. We pickled beets. We pickled tomatoes. We pickled carrots. We pickled cauliflowers. The concept was very different because it was a continental kitchen, is what we call it. So it was very global sort of a feel where you walk into the restaurant and you pay a flat charge, and they had a huge grill where you can pick any amount of food that you want. they grilled it and served it to you on the table. And then besides that, they had a little island in which they would serve international food. So that we were serving tamales, we were doing falafel, we were doing... Like, this was my first introduction to sort of a global style cooking. I mean, I'd pretty much eaten Indian food all the time. The first time I saw a Heinz bottle was in that hotel. Like, wow. I'd never even, like, I had... There was no, like... It was a very different experience for me to kind of start off on that trajectory. It was a lot of fun. Wow. A lot of learning.
Oh, I bet. And then at what point did you, like, come to the U.S. or did you work in other restaurants before that?
I mean, I worked at other hotels in Delhi after that. But I came here in the year 99 to do my master's at NYU, which I did in anthropology and food, or like food studies program.
Okay.
Where it was mostly...
I went to the food studies program too.
Yay! Go Marinesso!
Wow. And so what like prompted that to take a kind of a more anthropological and like a shift in how you looked at food?
So my frustration in working with India was I almost always felt like I wasn't using my brain. Mm. It was like, this is the recipe, follow it, make it. And like, you get into the rut of it and like, you're like just kind of going in and out of the kitchen all day long. And it's just like cooking the same things, even though we were making more global food throughout my career, I've always done it. But I always felt like there was more to food than just like I can cook in the kitchen. And, you know, throughout my schooling, I never used my brain. I was like the last bencher in the class. I got the lowest grades, but like I finally realized I had some brains and I wanted to use them. So my dad and I started looking at different programs that we were also like applied at CIA. I also applied for an MBA with Cornell University. I also applied for NYU. I got through all the schools that I pretty much applied to. And then when I came here and I went to NYU and I just started studying, I felt like something in my brain just kind of opened up. And I was like, wow, there's all these things about food that I'd never thought about. Because back then, like, there was not even a food section in India in the newspapers. I mean, that's the time period we're talking about.
Yeah.
And I remember the first class that I sat in, and I think it was Amy Bentley who was holding the session for the class. She was like, the most important thing is that you have to do is that you have to read the Wednesday New York Times every week. And I was like, what is that? I mean, I'm coming from a different country.
Yeah.
I'm coming from a different culture.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've never written a paper in my life. I don't know how to research a library. Because I know how to go to a library and look for a book.
Right,
but
that
it's a different...
kind of, that kind of approach to academia, I mean, that's totally different than like culinary training. It's like, it's a totally different way of using your skills. And you're in your early 20s at this point, right?
I was in my early 20s. Okay. Yeah. 24, 25. I'm just still trying to figure out. And then, of course, you know, I'm going to NYU, so I have to work 80-hour weeks, because I got to pay for this school.
Right.
My parents are not paying for this school.
Wow.
I'm paying for it. So I'm working, and I'm going to school full-time, and a lot of the times I was sleeping in the school and taking showers in the pool. Not in the pool, but in the showers in the pool area. And then going back and forth.
Wow. And where were you working?
So I was working at a place called, I'm legal now, so I can talk about it.
Okay.
Because I worked illegally.
Okay.
But I was working at a place called Between the Bread.
Okay.
And they used to be, back in the 80s, they were like the number one catering company. And they hired me as their cookie maker. So all I used to do was make cookies all day, pipe cookies. And then I went on to working for another company called Table Tales, which was also like sort of this corporate catering space owned by a woman owner. And she was very supportive of me and has stayed a friend throughout the years and just has like helped me in very different ways in terms of thinking process and stuff like that. There I was doing more and more pastry work.
And at that point, had you been able to start kind of expressing yourself through your pastry work, or were you still kind of beholden to someone else saying, here's, this is the recipe, you make it? Or
I think like Grace was her name. She did give me a little bit of freedom, but then, you know, I think it was still like American straightforward pastries, you know, and it's been going for a corporate world. It was the same thing. The first exposure really to like start or do something of my own was with Tamarind mm-hmm. restaurant, which I opened. So I met Hemant Mathur and Suvir was another person. We all kind of connected through NYU. And I started working for Tamarind because they were looking for someone to do a tea room concept for them. So this was my first exposure into doing something creative. So I created a tea room concept for them where the whole idea was to be able to sell the teas, be able to sell the chutneys that were being made in the kitchen, which they didn't do because it was someone telling them to do it. So of course not, it's not cool enough. But anyways, the idea was to kind of create this sort of a very retro space that was connected to Tamarind was, and also to create a branding experience beyond just like we went to dinner to Tamarind and it was good. It was something to kind of take back to mm-hmm. wherever you were going. Mm-hmm. And Tamarind's, of course, like an institution at this mm-hmm. point. They've been around forever.
Yeah. And how old were you at that point? Like that was...
How old was I? 25, 26.
Okay, so that was like around...
Around the same time. And everything was happening quickly.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And did like your academic work kind of... Were the two informing each other or...
I definitely think so. And also I do think that going to NYU helped because I actually started reading more and more about the food world and what the influences were. I also had this sort of a realization. So like for many years in... Growing up in India, the experience is very different, right? So when I started working in the hotels, I never wanted to work in the Indian kitchen. That is the worst kitchen you're going to be. Like, that's the whole colonial experience of us as Indians where we don't respect where we're coming from, what our roots are. And this is also 90s, right? Now it's a different world, but I'm talking 90s. And never wanted to work in an Indian kitchen. I wanted to work in a French restaurant. I wanted to go to CIA or I wanted to go to Switzerland and train under some Swiss chef and, you know, be the haute de culture, mm-hmm. couture, mm-hmm. whatever the word is, chef. And that was my dream. And then I came here and I started, reading these books that were given to me or assigned to me at NYU. And I started thinking about Indian food. It was so irritating because I kept going back to it. And, you know, when we used to do presentations of our different papers, as you know, in food studies, you do different. It was so frustrating because I was like, mine is a very blasé concept, but okay, here it is. And everybody used to get so excited. And I was like, that's not really that exciting. Like, you know, it's a different experience. So that once I did that, I realized that, oh, yeah, maybe I want to cook Indian food for a change.
Yeah, like maybe there's something...
There's something there.
There's obviously something
I missed something.
Were you one of the only like Indian students in the program at the time? Okay, because I know it's like having been there, it's a very white and very female, you know, I know it's changing, but...
Krishnendu Ray was already there.
Oh, I love Krishnendu.
I know. I know.
Shut up.
He was already there.
Okay.
So I used to, like, he used to not do that many regular classes, so I used to sneak into his classes.
And would he kind of push you to, like, engage more with your own
food
ways?
For sure. For sure.
Appreciate that more.
For sure. Like, actually, like, I had this whole one concept about... Indian Hindu-Muslim rivalry, and I wrote this big paper about mm-hmm. it, and it was very intense, and I had 5,000 books that I read. Not really, but you know what I mean. Yeah. Like, I didn't really
read it. It felt like it.
It felt like it, that I was reading through so many books. But he was very supportive, and like he really actually like helped me think about things in a way that I couldn't, because I was not from academics. It was a big movement, especially when you're writing an academic mm-hmm. paper, to think about... what is it that you're literally trying to say, mm-hmm. you know, instead of just like, you know, sort of in a poetic way. You don't want to write in a poetic way, you know, and everything needs to be spelled out. And, you know, this sort of whatever it is, like in terms of a food movement or in terms of Indian food, like what is it that defines us as a society, to kind of break it up into the cultural value of it, was a learning experience. Because I never thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. Because that was just my life.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it's like, it's normal, so therefore it's invisible.
Yeah, and then why is this interesting kind of a thing? Mm-hmm. Like, why is it interesting? Say, like, oh, like, I was a born and brought up vegetarian, and then when I started cooking in hotels, why is it interesting that when I get home, my mother sends me into a shower because I've been cooking meat all day? You know, it's a cultural value aspect of it that it was very frustrating because she was such a, you know, what's the word for it? When someone is very, not suspicious.
Like superstitious?
Superstitious, yeah, yes. Thank you. Someone's very superstitious that way. Like, I was totally very free-flowing child, whatever goes. And she was just the opposite. But it's an interesting idea, like, which I would have never thought was interesting in India.
Oh, yeah, because that idea of, like, yeah, unclean or clean, like, you've been touching meat, but you're in a vegetarian household, like, that, like, yeah, the politics of that are, like, yeah, and that's fascinating in a way that, translated here, that it doesn't work quite the same way.
Correct.
If anything, it's the opposite. Like, people are, like, if you've been eating vegetarian food, like, go bathe yourself. Like, I mean, that's changing, but, like,
yes.
Yeah, it, if anything, yeah, it goes the other way of, like, as far as the superstition and suspicion.
So I think, like, because I went to NYU, it further interested me into learning more about Indian food instead of the other way around, right? And then, of course, I started cooking in Indian restaurants, and that's just, like, spearheaded my career since then. And I basically pretty much read a lot about Indian food, so, and write about it. Whatever comes my way, I just keep doing it.
And did it tend to be, like, North Indian? Did you get really interested in other, like, regions? I mean, I don't know exactly if your family was always in Delhi, or whether, you know, like, what regions make up, like, your personal background, but did that prompt you to, like, really delve into it in its entirety?
So initially, definitely, I was more interested in North Indian food. I was also having more dialogue about how I ate in terms of my house, like, I think throughout my career, I'm pretty much a chef who talks about what is it that we're eating in our homes. And whether that's from the north of India, it's in the south of India, it's on the west or the east, like, that's the one part of it that just, like, really fascinates me. And, like, thankfully this time at this restaurant, I've been given a lot of freedom to kind of do the menu and do the concept and do the ideas of what I think kind of needs to be put on our plates in America. And a lot of the food items that I've picked here, or even in the past, like with Tulsi, which was one of the other restaurants, or Devi, that was one of the other restaurants, when I was given the freedom to, like, kind of do some combinations, I was very, very much like, this is how I cook in my house. Come and enjoy it. You know, like, a lot of the Indian restaurants, I feel, do a lot of creamy dishes where there's a lot of cream in the food, or there's a lot of, you know, they're very thick and heavy. And my friends, when they come, like, the food is just really light. It has a lot of water in it. It's very, like, we call, in Bengal, it's called jhol, which means water. In Hindi, it's called tari, which means also water. Like, you'll see that throughout, as a tangent, in any part of the country, when you eat in someone's home, there's very little oil. It's not, depending on the household, it can be spicy or not be spicy. But for the most part, it's really light. And so that's what I try to bring as an experience as a chef, because I feel this is how I eat, and I think this is how you should eat it too, because it's amazing just the way it is. Why do I need to change it and make it into something that's more American?
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, rather than cater to the taste of, you know, of, yeah, of, like, this culture, why not, like, push them to kind of come to you, meet you where you are? So we're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back just after this.
Are you experiencing ascension symptoms? I fall asleep, but I'm wide awake. I'm living color in a world of gray.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group, or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
Welcome back to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. My name is Leah Kurtz, and in the studio with me is Serbis Hani from Tsar Indian Bistro in New York City. And we're just discussing her pathway into becoming a chef and also kind of looking differently at Indian cuisine and kind of exploring its meaning and translating that into to kind of a more Western palate.
Wow, you made me sound so cool.
Well, you know, I'm here all night, folks. No, but really, let's like get back into that because I'm curious as to kind of, yeah, like you are the creative director at Tsar. And so I'm interested in how you chose some of the dishes. You said you were talking about like the desire to, you know, really look at different regions and not what would be in a restaurant, but like what are people eating in their homes and how different that flavor profile is from what people think of in the US maybe when they think of Indian food and how you how you get to play with that. And maybe, I don't know if you want to talk about some of your favorite dishes that you like.
Oh my God.
That really exemplify that sure. The most, like this idea sure. Of home cookery and really celebrating that.
Sure. So answering the favorite dishes is very hard mm-hmm. because I do like the entire menu. That's right. Why we put it together. But when I started putting the menu together, I really started thinking a little bit out of the box. In the sense, I started thinking about different communities. So, like, I started thinking about the Jewish community. I started thinking about the Parsi community. I started thinking about the Bengali community. I also started thinking about the Marwari community. I still haven't done Orissa and Assam, which is, like, my to-do list in the next kind of changes in the menus. But I feel like these regions are sometimes, especially in the North Indian style restaurants, which are, there's a lot of them in the city, are very underrepresented and never kind of talked about. So like, for example, like Bengali food is becoming, I'm also learning it as I'm, you know, I think like that's one of the true special experience of being an Indian chef is, or being an Indian chef in here in New York, is that I'm also learning as I'm kind of going, as I'm kind of finding myself, and as I'm pushing the boundaries, oh, I want to try this kind of food and I want to bring it to this platform. That experience for me is also really a learning experience. So I'm growing with the entire thing. So like, for example, in Bengali food, we're doing something that's called as, call it machar jol, which is a fish curry. Mm-hmm. Which is generally done with potatoes and cauliflower. And I'm serving it with patol bhaja, which is it's like a summer squash, but like it's a baby summer squash, no bigger than my finger. And this is fried in some mustard oil and just some salt and pepper. It's as simple as that. And it's served with some plain rice. And that's just the dish. Like, there's not that much of complication in terms of the flavorings of the dish. Even in the fish, there's like, when I'm cooking, there's a total of 5 or 6 spices, which is like, when we think about Indian food, we're like, oh my God, like I cannot cook Indian because there needs to be so
hundreds
many
of spices.
I do have that one dish that has hundreds of spices. Not 136, but just 36.
Yeah, only.
Only 36. But, you know, that's one of the rare dishes that we have. Or we're doing these latkes, which are called cauliflower latkes, which is from the Jewish community, which is pretty prevalent in India and is never represented or shown in any of the Indian food, and has influenced a lot of the cooking that happens in Goa and also a lot of the cooking that happens in West Bengal. Or for that matter, like we have, I mean, of course, everyone's eaten dosa, I think, by now. But a lot of the times when people make dosas at home, it's not always served with potatoes and it's not always breakfast. So I'm doing those soft set dosas with, which are like more softer, not the crunchy dosas that are folded over, with a black pepper, cochin black pepper chicken curry and some coconut chutney. So we're trying to stay very homey in our feel. The dishes are kind of made exactly how they should be made. So like if it's a black pepper chicken and it calls for these following ingredients, then we follow those. It's not like I have five generic sauces on my line and I just add a little bit of this or a little bit of that, and they're all kind of, everything kind of tastes the same at the end of it. Mm-hmm. And like, that's not the kind of food that we're cooking. So it just keeps it very, very real and very, very authentic. And then we're also, I mean, at the same time, we're of course like doing some experimental stuff at the restaurant where, for example, we're doing, eggplant bhartha, which is the eggplant dish, which is smoked eggplants and it's cooked with spices. Generally it's just served with plain rotis in my house. But I here make the rotis, cut them into chips and serve them as a dip. So it's fun. Nice. There's like some fun things. Or we have a mushroom risotto. Like my daughter is, of course, born here. And she really hates me because I make... She doesn't hate me. She really is frustrated because I make Italian food Indian style.
Ooh.
So this is an homage to my daughter's frustration. So she'll say, "You made Italian. Why do you have to put green chilies in everything?"
Hey, spicy risotto sounds good.
It's very good. We call it crack food.
And yeah, so this restaurant is a family affair.
Definitely.
You and your husband are at the helm of it. What is that like working side by side?
Oh, we've worked together 18-something years at this point.
Okay. Did you meet in the...
We met at NYU together.
Oh,
we,
okay, okay.
Yeah, he came in for a cooking class and we met and he was opening Tamarind and then we ended up working together.
Gotcha.
And had an arranged marriage. Go figure. Long story. Some other time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I wish we had time. But is this the first restaurant you've, like, the two of you have kind of really
collaborated?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think like we've been doing a lot of collaborative work since Devi. So like I've been spearheading events section part of it for him for many years. I mean, I'm known for as a pastry chef, but really I've just kind of done mainstream cooking all my life. It's just, I guess people like that logo of pastry chef. I'm a little frustrated by it, but no pun to doing pastries. I enjoy doing pastries. It is something that I've done for so many years. But I've also done a lot of savory cooking since I did it at Devi. Then at Tulsi, I did a lot of the menus with him in collaboration with him. You know, I've done a lot of back-end work with him at this point.
And yeah, like that is... I mean, that's totally a thing, right? For women to kind of get pigeonholed into pastry and then like kind of kept there. And so it's no wonder there's some like feelings around that. Do you want to talk about this?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's not a frustration against him. I do feel that the industry overall basis, you know, first of all, most people don't know because it's not being projected that way. And then I've also done a very bad job of not really going out there and talking about myself, which is not something that I'm very good at.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you so much. I got my flag on. My friends have said, you better host the flag today.
But yeah, sometimes it feels like it's not always easy to talk about those frustrations because... Not everyone wants to hear that. We definitely want to hear that here. We love to bitch.
You're basically trying to put me in a lot of trouble, and I'm happily taking it on. I think like the industry overall basis doesn't like to sometimes talk about the amount of work that is done by women, period. It's got nothing to do with just my circumstance. That's a running dialogue overall basis. I mean, if you really think about it, how many Indian women chefs are there in this country? There's only two. There's me, there's Mani Chauhan. That's it. There's no other Indian woman chef. And I feel like as other women chef organizations, they should be like talking, when you start talking about immigrant women that have moved from one country to another and have done the amount of body of work Mani or I have done, I don't think there's that much representation on a mainstream level. That's just the truth of it.
Yeah. And I mean, in the past few years, have you been more emboldened to talk about these things? Like, as like, you know, activism has kind of taken a role in our lives, as conversations around inequality in the culinary world, and whether it's, you know, sexism or racism or, you know, xenophobia or all of those three combined, like, have you felt more comfortable discussing those things?
I think I definitely do. I'm also in my 40s now.
So you don't give any fucks.
Yeah, I don't give any fucks anymore. You know, and like, actually, I would stand corrected. I do have a woman chef who's like as a sous chef in our restaurant in Sarso. There's other women chefs, but they're not like on, like, they're not being talked about. It's like the whole conversation piece. I think like I'm not scared anymore. I also don't feel that. I've come to a place where I'm like, what do I have to lose? You know, I mean, there was this one, I guess, like a dream idea that I had when I came to this country in terms of the kind of support that you find, which is, there has been support that may not like kind of put it down completely. But I do feel that it's been tough. It's been tough. It's been tough to survive. It's been tough to survive as in, even in terms of like Indian food, like representing Indian food and doing an Indian restaurant, even in terms of operating an Indian restaurant, even in terms of thinking about how well an Indian restaurant does in comparison to an American restaurant, even in terms of like how many people really talk about Indian food in an authentic sense, right? Like not, you know, in a generic sort of a sense, in the sense that how many media people that come in to an Indian restaurant or an Asian restaurant or a Chinese restaurant or a Japanese restaurant and review the restaurant, do they know that much about the food that they're writing about? That's always my number one question. And, you know, I do feel like there's a need for some sort of movement, especially, I mean, I can only talk about the Asian community, right? Like within the Asian community, Asian chefs, like across the board, doesn't matter what country they're coming from, to kind of come together and do something about it. Yeah, I'm flag hoisting. Leah, don't give me that look.
do something about it. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, and to receive like, kind of an assessment on the merit without, because like there's, I think it's very naive to think that, yeah, a critic or someone coming in is coming in with no baggage or no preconceived ideas about a cuisine, and certainly more like of a pejorative slant when it's not Western, for a lot of, especially when these, I mean, up until now, most critics have been straight white men and old ones. And so
thank you.
Like, what was someone said today to me, what is it? Pale, male, and stale.
You're getting me in trouble.
Shout out to Kim from Food Book Fair. So yeah, it's like that brings, like that person is going to totally experience the food differently and I'd be able to articulate it so much differently and to, of course, a lesser degree than someone who maybe has some background and a much more a better appreciation for that food.
Yeah. And I think like when you're like going into kind of dine in an immigrant space or like in a space that's not like totally like American or Italian or French or it's a good idea to take people that are from that country maybe to, I don't know if they're already doing it. Maybe they're already doing it. And I'm going to get some hate emails tomorrow morning. But, you know, I do feel, because when I read those reviews, when I see how the restaurants that are on that level being written about, I just like raise my eyebrow. I'm like, what? You know, like, so anyways, let's move on from that topic. You're getting me into enough trouble.
Well, in the last like few minutes, I guess I'm curious about what, like anything that you're working on, like any specific projects. I know you don't just, and not like just as in like it's simplified, but you're not only a chef, you're an instructor, you do events, like you are, you know, like, are you up to anything that we should know about that you want to talk about?
So I'm doing two major things right now. One is that, of course, I am increasingly focusing on our catering division and really spearheading that aspect of it. But more importantly, I've been, for the last few years, I've really been inclined about including some immigrant South Asian women to be part of my different projects. And I make that my... like that's really important for me. And I did quite a bit of work with this organization called Sapna, where we were delivering food to some adults, South Asian adults, another nonprofit. We were delivering lunches to them, and I was working with these women in the kitchen to teach them how to cook for these people. And then, but now I'm about to launch, I mean, of course, sweets and gift packaging sort of a products company, which is going to be in early part of next year, where these women are going to be my full-time employees. And that's a project that is going to hopefully be something that I work on for the next 10 years.
Wow, that's
exciting.
Yeah,
that's where I'm kind of heading, you know, like really making a woman-based company, and sort of do some work on the grassroots levels with them.
And that's like a beautiful full circle of like, correct, where you started, right? To like, yeah.
I really miss working with that many women. Yeah, I think like that's where it is. Yeah, that's why, you know, not that men are not great, but like I think women are greater.
We're in a time of not great men, so yes. Let's bring the women up. And where can we and our listeners like find you on social media? Either your personal social media, your restaurant, both? Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, my social media is Sani Surbi, I think, and Instagram. And then I'm also on Facebook, Surbi Sani. I mean, I'm also Saran, my sister, the restaurant. You should be able to find me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll link all those.
Yes, it's pretty easy. Not that complicated.
Well, Surbi, thank you so much for being on the show. It's been wonderful, like, hearing more about you, getting to meet you, and, yeah, learning more about the great work that you do and the delicious things that you're preparing. It's like, oh,
you should come and eat soon.
I know, I will. And thank you to our listeners for listening to another episode of Food Without Borders. You can find this episode for download later, if you didn't catch it live, on heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Spotify, and Stitcher, basically anywhere you can find a podcast, we are there. It's a great opportunity to also go visit some older episodes that maybe, you know, you've missed. We'll be back next week at 6 p.m. With a new episode. Until then, peace and love.
Thank you, Dia.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please Join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.